This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Welcome to Desert Island Discs, where every week I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, the book and the luxury item that they'd want to take with them if they were cast away on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music on these podcast versions is shorter than in the original broadcast. You can find over 2,000 more editions to listen to and download on the Desert Island Discs website. My castaway this week is the Russian chess champion, writer and political activist Garry Kasparov. Widely acknowledged as the finest player of all time, his attacking maverick style saw him christened the Beast of Baku. It's been a dozen years since he quit the professional game, but the depth of his strategic brilliance has ensured his ongoing legendary status. There may, mathematically speaking, be as many possible chess games as there are atoms in the visible universe, but even as a six-year-old that didn't seem to put him off. That was when he began playing, feeling immediately that chess was the ideal game for him. By 17, he was a grandmaster, going on just 5 years later to become the youngest ever world champion. He maintained that position for the next 20 years. Not content, however, with beating humans, he also took on man's fight against the machine, going head-to-head with the supercomputer Deep Blue. He won the first encounter, but lost the rematch. More recently, his energies have been occupied with an altogether less cerebral and a good deal more risky pursuit, decrying the leadership of Russian President Vladimir Putin, publicly denouncing what he calls his criminal regime and police state. He says, "If I look back at my life, I always follow the same algorithm, trying to make the difference, whether it's at the chessboard or in the surroundings of the chessboard or in my ordinary life." And so welcome, Garry Kasparov.
Thank you.
When you say ordinary life, I think we can all agree, first off, that you haven't had much of an ordinary life. But I know what you mean from that comment. You retired from competitive chess properly 2005.
Yeah.
Do you miss winning?
Winning is not just moving the chess pieces. You just mentioned making the difference. And that's one of the most valuable lessons from my childhood, from my mother. And I'm very happy with my chess experience, with the knowledge of the game helping me to meet these challenges.
In the sort of common man's perception of what elite champions do, we understand what athletes do or tennis players do. You know, we can see it. How does a championship chess player prepare? I mean, you know, you're not in the gym. You're not with the nutritionist. What are you doing in preparation?
Oh, by the way, I spend a lot of time in the gym. I would say physically probably the strongest player of my generation.
Was that important? Was that a part of it?
It was, for me, it was very important because my style was very dynamic.
Yes.
It required a lot of energy. And that's why I could stay on top for so long, beating even next generation, because I had plenty of energy and physical strengths to go through long tournaments. Chess tournaments, they used to be pretty long. So the typical world championship match was 10 weeks, so when I played Karpov. And the big tournaments, 2 weeks, you know, up to 20 days. And if you are engaged in this competition, it's not just making the moves at the chessboard. It's about preparation. It's about going through these moments of the game that you just played. So it's 2 weeks of almost 24/7 chess. Trust me, it's nerve-wracking. And if you don't have enough strength, physical strength, you will never survive to the end of the competition. That's why I always dominated in the last few rounds, because my younger opponents, they didn't have the same energy, the same passion, the same determination.
Let's go to some of your music then, Garry Kasparov. Tell me about your first disc, a little bit about this and why it's important to you.
Sinatra's, you know, voice distinctive and rich is just, it's amazing. But it also has a connection to one moment in my life in 1976. One of my first coaches, Alexander Nikitin, he traveled abroad and he brought back a disc. That's a disc for a tape recorder. And it had some Western music, which was not available normally in the Soviet Union. And it had many of Sinatra's songs. For me, it was just, you know, the moment of revelation. I actually had some difficulty of selecting one of the songs. But then I decided Strange in the Night because it's more romantic. And it's also one of the favorite songs of my wife.
Let's hear it.
Strangers in the night, exchanging glances, wandering in the night, What were the chances we'd be sharing love before the night was through? Something in your eyes was so inviting, something in your smile.
That was Frank Sinatra and Strangers in the Night. You had a smile right across your face there, Garry Kasparov, when you were listening to that.
Yes.
You have a wonderful turn of phrase. You once described the IBM computer Deep Blue as a $10 million alarm clock. That made me laugh. What were your feelings about the whole enterprise in your first match, which was in 96 against it?
It was not the first time I met a computer at the chessboard. This was the first time where machine met the world champion at the chessboard under normal tournament conditions. That was a real 7 hours game. And if we are looking for the watershed moment in history, actually it's 1996, not 1997, because though I won the match of the six games, I won three games, I lost one, but I lost game one in the match. And basically, if you want to have this, to put it, milestone, that was the moment, because the rest, from the scientific perspective, was just a matter of time. It's like a writing on the wall. If machine could win one game, the rest could come 1 year later, 2 years later, 3 years later. That was the biggest challenge ever. I remember the cover of Newsweek, The Brain's Last Stand. I mean, no pressure. After this match, I played a few other computer matches. Again, not as publicized, and I did better than in this match. But it's not something that, you know, changed everything dramatically, because what we learned from that, and that's why I said it's as intelligent as an alarm clock, because contrary to the expectations of founding fathers of computer science, like Alan Turing, Claude Shannon, Norbert Wiener, the machine that prevailed in the game of chess was a brute force.
Well, yes, let's just talk for a moment about that brute force. You know, this, as you've described, the brute force of computer calculation, how do you think it has changed the modern game in ways that somebody like me can understand?
Yeah, but it's what I can tell by learning from all these experiences is that if we are dealing with a closed system, and any game is a closed system because we have the rules, and it's quantifiable, machines will do it better. Because it's not about solving the game. It's about winning. Winning means prevailing over humans. And even the best humans were doomed to make mistakes. It's just, it's inevitable.
Let's have some more music, Garry Kasparov. Tell me about the second piece we're going to hear today.
It goes all the way back to my childhood. I just, somehow the music just enchanted me. But then also it's connected to one of my favorite movies, Amadeus. It's an easy flow, but it's you can also depths and strengths, and it's a sign of genius. And Amadeus is a great story. Somehow I could make a projection to my life, because
funny that.
I could make moves, you know, with the same easy flow. And that's, this music reminds me of the touch of genius, where you can just do simple things, but it ends up with a masterpiece.
That was part of the first movement from Mozart's Symphony No. 40, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted there by Herbert von Karajan. So, Garry Kasparov, you were born in Baku in 1963 in Azerbaijan.
I would say the deep south of the Soviet Union.
So your dad was Jewish, your mum was Armenian.
Yes.
I'm wondering what sort of parents it takes to make a grandmaster chess champion. Tell me more about your parents.
I have very vague memories of my father. He died when I was 7.
And what was his job? What did he do?
He was chemical engineer. So, and my mother was also engineer. So she worked it's an institution that built equipment for oil industry in Baku.
When I was introducing you today, I didn't know whether to say you were five when you started playing or you were six. You were around about five and a half, actually.
Nobody knows. I mean, yeah. There was no Twitter to report it.
So you were watching your parents try to solve a little chess puzzle in the newspaper, right?
Yes, that's most likely, yes. And I was so fascinated by these mysterious pieces, you know, the little board with the 64 squares. And my father immediately picked it up because everybody on his side was somehow connected to music. So my grandfather was in charge of the programs in Philharmonics in Baku. My father also graduated in class of violin. My uncle, he's a composer. And my father, when he realized that I was so engaged in game of chess, his last decision in his life was, he told my mother, already he had leukemia, he knew he was dying. He said, no music, he has a different kind of mind, send him to chess.
And he died of leukemia.
Yeah, at age 39.
39, a very young age to die. And as you say, you were only seven. Were you an only child?
Yeah, and my mother, she made a big decision not to remarry and spend her life for a son.
I will talk about that in a moment, but I was interested to read, and I'm interested to know if it's true, that your father decided that he did not want you to see him in the final weeks of his life.
Yes, that's what my mother told me. Probably wanted me to remember him still being strong. He was physically very strong, never had any kind of sickness. And I think that was the right decision. My memories are just, you know, always connected to him smiling, being strong, carrying me and just reading with me. So it's all positive, not the gloomy, dark moments of a dying man.
We're coming back, of course, but we need to fit in the music, Garry Kasparov. This third piece you've chosen, the Chopin, tell me about why it's important to you.
It's a revolutionary etude. It makes me feel stronger because it's like a challenge. It's not just name revolutionary etude. It's, I hear the music of change. So it's the, you have to make the difference.
That was Chopin's Etude Opus 10, number 12, performed there by Vladimir Ashkenazy. You said an extraordinary thing just before the last piece of music. You were talking about your mother and you said that she decided that she would not remarry and she decided that she would devote her time and her energies to
That's
me and my chess.
Did.
That's incredible.
She didn't know yet. Chess looked promising, but it was just about her son. So that was her big decision.
You're a parent. What do you make of that? The fact that she decided that it would be you and only you that would be the focus of her adult existence. That's an extraordinary decision
to make. It is an extraordinary decision, and that's why I always feel very close to her. It's a tough time now because since February 2013, almost 5 years, I had to live outside of Russia for obvious reasons, because the trip to Russia will be for me a one-way ticket as long as Putin stays in power. And she's still in Moscow, but we talk every day. There are a few rules I don't dare to break. Is when my plane takes off or lands, I must call her. It
Good.
Could be 4 in the morning in Moscow, midnight, whatever at the time. And she's 80 now. She actually made some other important decisions because she prevented me from just getting into this big chess too early. So she just tried to sort of limit this engagement to make sure that when I meet challenges, I will be mature enough. So from early days, she was like a top manager of the team.
Was she tough? Was she your protector?
There was a big moment. I learned about it later when I played Anatoly Karpov the first match in 1984. And it's at the beginning, it was a total disaster. I lost 4 games out of first 9. And the winner had to take 6 games. So Karpov was so close to a big, big triumph. And it's my game, just it looked bleak. So I couldn't actually find the right algorithm. So it just somehow I failed to show what was my real strengths. And some of my coaches, they have been influenced by the outsiders, and they tried to talk to my mother to convince me to give up. So basically to stop playing and just, you know, to resign, to avoid the total disaster, because losing 6-0 would be too painful. And she said, no. He has to go through everything. So just if this is his fate to lose the match so badly, let's see what happens with him, because this is the only way to temper his character.
Some more music, Garry Kasparov. Tell me about this. We're going to listen to your fourth. Why have you chosen this one? This is from Phantom of the Opera.
I'm not afraid to be accused of being a populist, but it's also as very important personal note to me. It's the first musical show I watched with my wife. So in 2003 in New York, now it's like our sort of our family music, because our daughter somehow either she picked it up and she has been trying to play it, and now she can do it. It's a bit scary, and it starts this suspense. And I'm every time I hear, just you know, it brings me back to this some great moments of our family life. If we have to choose sort of a musical motto for our family, it'll be Phantom of the Opera.
The overture to Phantom of the Opera, composed by Andrew Lloyd Webber and performed by members of the original London cast recording. Garry Kasparov, at the time when you started travelling the world because of your chess, you would have been how old?
13.
What struck you about the West as a youngster?
I can hardly describe my feelings when I was chosen to represent Soviet Union in the World Championship under 16. I was 13 in 1976. Of course, they didn't let my mother to travel with me.
They didn't?
No, because it's family, and the rules were very strict because the family could stay.
So you had to have a reason to come home.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Absolutely. That's the way the communist regime worked. I was probably the only person in just definitely in my school, probably in my street, maybe in my district in Baku, who traveled to the capitalist country. I could see that life was different. It's not so that much of this consumer abundance, but more of just, it's a different air, freedom. So that's something, the people behave differently. That's actually what I picked it up.
So Muhammad Ali had Joe Frazier, you had Anatoly Karpov, and he became, you know, your matches between each other became legendary. I want you just for a moment to take me to winning against him in the World Championship and to the particular day and moment. What was going on, not in playing the moves, but in your emotions at the moment of winning?
It's very hard to squeeze everything in few words, because the title of World Chess Champion in the Soviet Union, it was more than just a world champion.
Yes.
It was something absolutely unique. Many people who supported me, they said it's the moment that Garry Kasparov has won this game and won the title and became the world champion and Karpov lost, they realized that the whole system may one day collapse.
Explain that to me.
Because Karpov was, he became so close to
the establishment.
It's not only close to establishment, a part of the establishment.
Yes,
and the
yes.
fact is that he was received by Brezhnev and yes. he got all the awards and he was the system. And I was not a rebel, so I just played by the rules. I didn't want to be seen as somebody who's challenging the system. But he was a Russian world champion, darling of the system, received by the top officials, including Leonid Brezhnev himself. And I was half Armenian, half Jewish from Baku, though enjoying support of local party officials who gave me some protection to organize preparation. I mean, not to be deprived of coaches and certain help that I needed to challenge Karpov. But still, it was I wouldn't say David and Goliath, but it's there. And I didn't feel it so distinctively as many other people, all the people, because I heard it and only many years later I just realized that it's a moment of revelation. Karpov lost. Maybe the whole system, God knows, maybe the whole system could one day go bust.
Let's take a break for some music, Garry Kasparov. Tell me about your next one. This is your fifth.
That's connected to these matches. It's Vladimir Vysotsky. This song, I'm not sure translation is correct, Capricious Horses, but let's...
Or Wild Horses, is that
closer? It's a combination. It's Wild Horses, Capricious Horses, Untamed Horses. So that's the... But it's about a challenge. So it's... And for the first three matches with Karpov, the 48 games in the first match, the unlimited match, 84-85, then second match, 24 games, and another 24 games in 1986. Before each game, I listened to the song because it charged me with energy. And even when I was losing so badly, I still could get some hope. That is, it's the always just one step away from abyss. So that's your challenge. If you survive, one day you'll prevail.
Вдоль обрыва, понад пропастью, по самому, по краю, я коней своих нагайкою стигаю, погоняю, что-то воздуху мне мало, ветер пью.
That was Vladimir Vysotsky and Kony Privedlyevye. How did I say? Is that okay?
Privedlyevye.
Oh, I got it the wrong way around. Anyway, it means untamed or capricious horses.
Yes, yes. Wild, yes.
Wild horses. In January of 1990, a very important thing happened in Azerbaijan. It was the result of ethnic violence between the Armenians and the Azerbaijanis. And you and your family, as I understand it, were forced to flee. What do you... Is that accurate, first of all, that you were forced to flee? Because that's what I read.
What do you mean forced to flee? So
you chose to flee.
There were pogroms. So this is the... Armenians were wiped out from the city of Baku. We don't know how many, probably a few hundred have been killed. And tens of thousands had to, they were simply expelled. So we had to leave the town. So it was a very tough moment because I had no plans of leaving Baku, but I knew there was no choice and I had to take as many people as I could with me. So we just moved to Moscow.
It's not strictly democratic, but it is a relatively stable place now. Do you ever go back to Azerbaijan?
No. You said not democratic and stable. It's a dictatorship. It's
family, I said it was stable and it was not democratic.
Oh, yeah. It's a family dictatorship. And I've no intention of just going there because I was just born there. Because
no.
At the end of the day, it's... I wish I could go there one day. I could take my family, actually, to show the place where I was born.
Yes.
But the city is not... It's not just stones. Though, for instance, Armenian cemetery has been desecrated. So that's the... My father's is the Jewish cemetery still there, so it's just it's in good shape. I saw the pictures, so it's this. Some people brought it to me after Chess Olympiad in Baku in 2016. So they went just to see the place where I was born. Now it's a store of the women clothes there, and of course no mention that I was born in Baku.
Does that matter to you?
No, it's not. There were probably three people with world fame who were born in Baku: Rostropovich, Landau, the Nobel Prize winner, and myself. And the first two, of course, properly reflected in the history of the town. And I am not there because I'm Armenian. I'm fine. So just it's not...
Are you fine? That would matter to me.
A lot of people still remember that's where I was born and what I did for my native town. Because now Azerbaijan is one of the leading chess powers. And that started with me, with my ascension and my rise to the top.
So that's a kind of cultural legacy then that you have there.
Yeah, yes. Yes, exactly. I believe I will visit the place one day because I'm a good scholar of history. All dictators, they're doomed. And this dictatorship will not last forever. And when we see a different political landscape, I'm sure I'll take a trip down south.
Let's have some more of your music. We are on now your sixth piece. Tell me about this, Garry Kasparov.
It's sheer energy. It's blood boiling. No special connection to my family, my professional life, but it makes me feel more energetic.
Thank you.
was the prelude from Bizet's Carmen, performed there by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Sir Simon Rattle. So, Garry Kasparov, since retiring then from the professional game, you've used your platform of world renown to draw attention to what you believe are the failings of the regime and the Russian president himself, Vladimir Putin. Your straightforward accusations then, just to sum it up, is that it is a criminal regime and it is a police state, in essence. Would that be fair?
It was fair. Now it's much worse. It's a one-man dictatorship. It was a police state 10 years ago, and I've been shouting in the desert, trying to bring attention to the fact that this regime was on the way of turning into open dictatorship that would go after other countries. That's what happened with other dictators. They destroyed opposition in their own countries. They were in charge, in total control. But eventually, they all needed new targets to justify their endless stay in power. And I knew that Putin would go elsewhere, first to the neighboring countries, former Soviet republics, and eventually he would defy the biggest, the most powerful countries in the world. And that's why what's happened during US elections and many elections in Europe and all these now renowned facts of Russian interference has been predicted. I don't want to... I'm tired saying I told you so. And I want one day just to be proven wrong.
You are, of course, no longer living in Russia. You live now in exile in New York with your wife and family. But for many years, you did put yourself literally on the front line of protests. You served short spells here and there in prison for taking part in demonstrations. What do you see your role now as from the outside to try to get what you believe to be justice for the people in your country?
It's very important to explain, and unfortunately I have to repeat it time and again, the true nature of Putin's regime. Just stop using words elections, stop pointing out at polls, because you never know what people think, because many of them have this genetic fear of expressing their views. They were born in the Soviet Union. And speaking openly about a KGB dictator, it just goes against their life experience. And also, if you have one restaurant in town serving only one dish, this dish is popular.
Do you worry yourself and for your own safety? I mean, of course, famously, people who make enemies of Vladimir Putin come to very sticky ends. We only have to think of the journalists.
It's a long list.
Yeah, it's a very long list of journalists.
Especially of those who left in Russia, like my great friend and ally, late Boris Nemtsov, who actually advised me to leave the country, but... It's tragic that he was so proud and so he felt so tough. And as a former deputy prime minister under Yeltsin, many believed Yeltsin's potential successor. And he stayed there and he was murdered just in front of Kremlin in February 2015.
It is a long line of people who have met their ends, who have openly criticized him.
Some of them live in this town, in London.
Yes, indeed. I imagine you're not drinking tea at an anonymous hotel anytime soon.
No, I don't drink tea with strangers. I live in New York. I have a certain list of countries I wouldn't visit to make sure that I'm not running too much risk. But if you're asking me about my safety...
I'm asking you if you feel safe, yes.
Would it help? At the end of the day, it's the only good answer. Would it help? I do what I believe is right. I will keep doing that. I'm here... talking to you here in the studio in London. I live in New York, so I travel mostly in the free world. There's still many people in Russia who are on the front line, and they have no protection at all. So, look, I think I'm the only one who can help by just talking about Putin's regime and explaining that the keys to the freedom of my country are here in the banks and in financial institutions that are keeping and investing this enormous fortunes of Putin's cronies and henchmen.
Got to fit in the music, Garry Kasparov. So let us go then to your seventh piece. Just tell me about this choice. Why is it in your list?
Going back to our political discussion, I always recommend people to read Mara Puzo, Godfather, if they want to know more about Putin. And it's one of my favorite movies.
Thank you.
part of the Godfather Waltz from the original film soundtrack composed by Nino Rota and conducted by Carlo Savina. Do you play with your kids? Are they interested in chess?
No. Let's see about the little one. To elder kids, they had no interest. The 11-year-old daughter, so she expressed some interest, but I probably have to take this criticism from my wife that I didn't do enough to actually encourage her to do more. She knows how to play. She likes the game, but she's more engaged in reading and in music.
That would you like to have a little chess champion? Would you want that life for one of your kids?
If we believe the laws of genetics, I have to watch their kids because it's always the next generation.
So you'd be a proud grandfather of a chess champion,
maybe.
You're a man, clearly, of many facets and many talents, but I don't know how good you are at the practical stuff of life, and you know that I'm about to cast you away on a desert island. Will you be able to survive? Are you a practical person?
No, I'm not a very practical person, but I'm a survivor. So I will have to learn. So if you throw me there, I'll do my best to learn how to stay alive.
Tell me about your eighth disc then, your final one. Why have you chosen this?
Few reasons. Actually, one of them is that it's not exactly the desert island, but this is about survival. It's Morricone, Ennio Morricone. And this music is, I could feel this deep connection with the movie itself. I've chosen the main theme from The Professional, the movie, 1981 with Belmondo. Don't mix with 1994, De Leon. I think it's the best Belmondo movie, just with great characters, and it feels so contemporary. But this is one of the movies, not typical, where you don't have a happy end, but it's about the main character doing everything perfectly and still dying at the end because he went against the system. But you could be truly impressed by his determination to do what he thought was right.
Kimai, composed by Ennio Morricone. It's time now, as I do with every castaway, Garry Kasparov, for me to give you some books. I give everybody the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare to take to this little island, and they get to choose one other book to take with those two. What is your book going to be?
Master Margarita, Bulgakov.
Ah, Bulgakov, that's yours.
That's easy.
Okay, and a luxury too.
Telescope.
Sure.
Double use, I could watch the stars. And I always wanted to spend time. Never had enough time, and I assume the desert island is in the south, the Southern Sea. So there's plenty of stars there to watch, and also you can use it just looking for. Potentially for a ship.
Okay, well, for the practical use, that's your business, and I'm going to pretend you didn't tell me that. But for the stars, we will certainly.
No, but that's what again. It says I'm trying to be practical. it also has a practical use.
I can't blame you for that. You've chosen eight discs today. If the seas were to threaten to wash them away, which one would you run to save above all others?
Mozart.
It's yours, Garry Kasparov. Thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island.
Thanks
discs.
For inviting me.
I hope you enjoyed this edition of Desert Island Discs with Garry Kasparov. You'll find more interviews with sports stars, scientists, musicians and artists and more at bbc.co.uk/Desert Island Discs.
This is the BBC.
Hi, I'm Rhianna Dillon, and I just wanted to let you know about another podcast that I think you might like. It's called Seriously, and twice a week we bring you incredible documentaries from BBC Radio 4. We like to say they're seriously interesting stories, told a little sideways. From politics to fashion, arts to current affairs, I'm sure there will be something that takes your fancy. So join me there. Just search for Seriously in your favourite podcast app.